Professor David Wilson has spent his professional life working with violent men, especially men who've committed murder. And aged 29, he became at that time the UK's youngest ever prison governor in charge of a jail. He's written a brilliant new book called My Life with Murderers. And we're delighted to welcome David to the show. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Bill. Thank you for having me on the program.
No problem. It sounds like your route to prison governor was a fascinating one, because I believe you kind of were in a completely different field, and you had a PhD in history before that.
History and philosophy, and I simply became interested in how people became labelled as an offender. And it was actually a game of rugby. I played rugby that really started me on the route to joining the prison service, because I was aware that the violence I was expected to show on the rugby pitch and the violence that I was supposed to accept from my opponents led to some kind of aspirational reward, whereas exactly similar types of violence by young men in the streets of the university where I went to, the university town where I went to, led inexorably to Borstal. Mm. And I wanted to understand, why does exactly the same behavior in different contexts leads to different conclusions?
How fascinating. And I mentioned there you were 29 when you became the youngest ever prison governor in charge of a jail. That's quite a meteoric rise, isn't it, in that game?
Well, initially, I joined the prison service straight after my PhD, so it meant that I was 23. I started as assistant governor under training at Wormwood Scrubs in London, and at the time, the prison service had a scheme called the assistant governor scheme, and it was really in existence for people who were retiring from the army, and occasionally they would be prepared to take some bright young people from Oxford or Cambridge. And I was one of those people in 1983 that they chose to accept onto the scheme. And so my contemporaries at the time were much older than I was, and they were usually coming from a military or a service background, and I was therefore the odd one out in that respect.
So tell us about your role as a governor. I'm sure many people don't know much about the role. Do you have much freedom, or are you really carrying out the will of others?
Well, it's a combination of both, whereby I'm expected to carry out the rules related to the legislation, the various Prisons Act, and I'm expected to be, therefore, the person who will translate that legislation into a living reality behind the walls of the jail. That having been said, every prison governor, and to this day, I would say this still holds true, every prison governor has a great deal of power and authority, and their individual choices about those rules and how those rules are made to come to life gives that individual governor an ability to make life tolerable within the walls of a prison, or frankly, to make life miserable within the walls of a prison. And so the governor really does have old-fashioned, what the lawyers might call sui generis power, to really create a culture which is either beneficial and reformative, or in fact, something completely different.
And I would assume that your role is easier or more difficult depending on where you happen to be governor. What about in your case?
Yes, that's also true. And I deliberately set out to go to institutions that I felt best fitted the kind of philosophy, moral philosophy, and the personal values that I had. And in particular, I came to govern the only prison in the whole of Europe that operates as a psychodynamic therapeutic community called HMP Grendon. And that's a very specialized prison where it will accept men who have very violent pasts, have committed very violent crimes, but instead of simply locking them up, those men will be in therapy groups so that their entire day is structured around talking about their childhood, why they might have committed crime, their journey into a life of crime, and more importantly, learning how to live, albeit within the therapeutic community, learning to live without creating more victims or committing further crimes. So I deliberately chose places to govern that fitted the kind of rehabilitative ideals that I had, which were what it was that attracted me to the prison service in the first place.
That's interesting. So how much of your day then would be spent in the company of the prisoners? Or were you mainly office bound and occasionally you'd meet them for chats or whatever?
No, again, that would be something, Bill, that very much I tried to choose environments in which I would be able to meet with prisoners. And so even Grendon obviously is a very unique case in that I would spend the majority of my time with prisoners. But even in the other jails that I would go on to have a variety of different roles within, I would tend to try and spend at least half my day working with prisoners. And it was only because when I started to get promoted that I would be taken out of that world and asked to become much more of a bureaucrat, a civil servant. Mm. And that's when I no longer wanted to be a prison governor, because it was no longer the type of job that I had originally joined the prison service to do.
From looking at what you write in the book, you were fairly closely involved with prisoners. For example, you'd play rugby with some of them, or even go for a pint with them. Or in fact, you even went to an ex-con's wedding with your wife. So you were getting close to them, but I guess close in a professional sense.
Close in a professional sense, but the two of the incidents that you allude to there, I went to the wedding of once, he was of Noel Razor Smith, who was once Britain's most prolific bank robber.
Right.
Noel was somebody that I met at Grendon. He went through 5 years of therapy. He has subsequently been released from prison. He no longer commits crime. He is very settled within the community in which he lives. And when he got married to his partner, my wife and I were delighted to go to his wedding. Mm. And I regard him as a friend. That would not be the case with very many prisoners that I've worked with, who, of course, as you say, I would have maintained a professional relationship with, as opposed to an interpersonal relationship with.
I remember vividly when I used to work many years ago at Isle of Wight Radio, and our radio station was pretty much across the road from Parkhurst and the other prisons there, and we occasionally had to go and play football in the prison grounds of Parkhurst, where they had a football pitch, against the prisoners and the prison warders, of one of whom was my brother. And it was always a strange thing that, you know, you thought, well, do I really go in for this tackle, Hart, because that guy maybe was a murderer?
And you were alluding there to rugby. When I was governing at a young offender institution called Huntercombe, which is near Henley in Oxfordshire, it was fairly normal for prison staff. I was a young man still. I was in my mid-20s to play with the prisoners in the same rugby team.
Wow.
And we would often take that rugby team to play against local sides outside of the prison. And it was in that environment that we would often, at the end of a game, have a drink in the bar before going back to the young offender institution itself. And nobody in the mid-1980s thought there was anything wrong at all in doing that.
Yeah.
And indeed, it served to humanize who we were. It served to create a connection between those who had done wrong and those who were on the other side of the legal system. And I thought that that was actually a very good thing.
When we were talking about it earlier this morning, myself and Hannah, who does the breakfast show, we were trying to kind of come to terms with what makes a man kill another man. And I guess there must be two distinct types, maybe more. One who it's a complete and utter accident. You know, one day something flips and something terrible happens and somebody ends up dead. Or that's quite different from somebody who plans murders and they're completely and utterly premeditated. I guess you came across both types.
Yes, and the book attempts to talk about those types of murderers. I say that murder is a very slippery phenomenon. It's diverse. It doesn't really lend itself to easy definitions. And indeed, I would perhaps take issue, Bill, with what you said about your first definition. Mm-hmm. Usually, I don't find people snapping. The people I worked with might claim that they had snapped,
right.
But often when you look into their background, there is a history to the context in which they will go on to kill. But you are quite right that there is a world of difference between some of the serial killers that I've worked with, and obviously in the book I talk a great deal about my professional relationship with Dennis Nielsen, which lasted for decades, and somebody who might have killed one person in one type of setting. And clearly, when dealing with a serial killer such as Nielsen, one is dealing with a very different type of phenomenon from the general phenomenon of murder in the United Kingdom, where we've got to remember that two women a week are murdered by their partners or ex-partners. That is the context in which most murder in our culture takes place, and therefore the context is usually domestic violence. There's a world of difference between that and somebody like Nielsen, who will gain a sexual satisfaction from killing time after time after time.
And when you're speaking with somebody like Nielsen, who has that attitude, was Nielsen, for example, a boastful person? Was he proud of what he'd done? Did he like to, you know, tell you the detail of it? Or was he just a kind of a guy who just rambled incoherently because he was mad?
Well, again, Nielsen wasn't mad by any recognized definition of the 1983 Mental Health Act. He had a personality disorder. I would say that he was psychopathic, but he was perfectly sane. He was rational. It's just that the reasoning that led him to murder would not be the reasoning that you and I would adopt. Nielsen was incredibly narcissistic. Nielsen would use me often simply to test out his own pet theories about why he had ended up killing some 13 young men. There's always some debate as to the actual numbers that he killed. I think we settle on 13. Nielsen was therefore somebody who was interested in power and control, and he simply wanted to use me, perhaps because I was a young man when I first met him. He was the first murderer that I met when I joined the prison system in Wormwood Scrubs, and I was 24 years old, and so I think I slightly reminded him of some of the young men that he had killed. So I think he simply used me as a sounding board, and when he obviously realized I was Dr. Wilson, I had a PhD in history and philosophy, when he realized I had that kind of academic background, he would try and test out some of his theories. And I think actually I've always tried to give Nielsen credit for one thing, Bill, is that he genuinely was still working through why it was he had taken the lives of so many young men, whereas most of the other serial killers that I met during my career and worked with during my career would rarely discuss the murders that they had committed at all.
Would he take offense at you calling him a psychopath?
Oh, God, yes. He would take offense, not in the sense that he would try and attack me. He would write after meeting me when I had described him in that way. He would write voluminous letters to me claiming that my use of that term had been inappropriate. Nielsen wanted ultimately to see himself, and I'm using a phrase that he himself wrote in a letter to me, that he was an ordinary man, no different to you. This is how he would write.
Yeah.
I am an ordinary man, no different to you, except I've come to an extraordinary conclusion.
Wow.
And that conclusion was, of course, that he would take the lives of other people.
Incredible. Incredible. You mentioned females earlier, and in the book you also mentioned the fact that there's a much lower percentage of female murderers compared to men. Did you ever rationalize why that is?
I think it's got to do with social convention. I think it's got to do with the roles that women have historically played in our culture, a role that is changing. I think, though, what's interesting, despite the fact that there are fewer female murderers, if they do commit murder, they tend to be regarded more heinously than a comparable male offender. And when I do public talks, for example, I ask people to name some British serial killers, and I can absolutely assure you that the first names that are mentioned would not be Dennis Nielsen or Harold Shipman, but would be Myra Hindley and Rose West.
Interesting.
I think if women kill, they are doubly deviant. They're seen to be doubly deviant. Not only are they breaking the law, they're breaking a gender stereotype about what it means to be a woman. Mm-hmm. And therefore, they live longer in the public's imagination. And so I keep pointing out in my public talks, women are more likely to be the victim of a murder than the person who will commit the murder. But nonetheless, we still view female murderers through a very, very small prism of high profile and atypical people who have committed that crime.
A final question, and this could be the trickiest one, I guess. If you were still a prison governor, would you be happy with the state of the prison service in the United Kingdom currently?
It's not a difficult question to answer. I would have resigned. And you have to remember that I did resign anyway about the state of our prisons in 1997.
Wow.
They have not got better since I have left the prison service. In fact, I would put to you that they've got slightly worse. And if I may, because I know that was your last question, if I may end on this, I like to paraphrase Dostoevsky. You judge a civilization by how it treats its prisoners. Mm. By that definition, we cannot regard ourselves as civilized in this country whatsoever.
Interesting place to end. The book is very, very interesting indeed. My Life with Murderers, it's called. Professor David Wilson, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate your time this morning.
You're very welcome.
All the best. Cheers, then. Bye-bye.